Go for it.
Okay. Welcome, everyone. Today is February 28th, 2017, and this is the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. And I'm going to start by possible introduction of committee bills. So open committee bill work session. And Vice Chair Sanchez, could you please read us the possible committee bills?
Chair Kenny-Geyer, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. AC 3768, dated 2-1-17. LC 3769, dated 1-26-17. LC 3770, dated 1-27-17. LC 3771, dated 1-26-17. LC 3772, dated 1-26-17. LC 3773, dated 1-26-17. LC 3561, dated 1-25-17. LC 2267, dated 11-28-16.
Okay, Rep. Sanchez moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 3768, dated 2-1-17, LC 3769, dated 1-26-17, LC 3770, dated 1-27-17, LC 3771, dated 1-26-17, LC 3772, dated 1-26-17, LC 3773, dated 1-26-17, LC 3561, dated 1-25-17, LC 2267, dated 11-28-16. Before I ask if there's any discussion, let me just explain that the first, all but the last two are simply placeholder bills. They're related to foster care, related to OYA, Oregon Youth Authority, completely just bills that if we find, as anything comes up, that we want to actually work on a bill, this gives us a chance to do it. Any of you could look at those titles, and if there's something that you want to work on, there's no idea of how we would want to use those, and probably we won't use any of them at this point. The LC 3561 is relating to local transient lodging taxes in coastal counties. This came to me from somebody who is worried about all of the vacation rentals taking away a lot of the housing on the coast. I actually thought about introducing this myself, but it seemed a little funny since it's coastal, and if it didn't say coastal, I probably would have done it. I think it's an idea worth considering. And then LC 2267, relating to persons who are blind. This has to do with the Blind Commission and the Blind Vending Program. This is an LC that I drafted, and there's a lot of work to still do on this, and rather than put my name as a personal supporter of this, I wanted to make sure that it was in the condition we would want it before before attaching my name to it, frankly. So, but it, the idea, I did give the note to Mother for Commission on the Blind to work on this, and we're still doing a lot of work on it.
So, Madam Chair, on that last one, are you giving full disclosure on that?
Yes, I am. I am. And anyone that would like to work with me on that, I would really appreciate it. Is there any discussion on any of these bills? Because if we have a huge agenda today, and I'm hoping to, that as a reminder, this doesn't mean that you support any of the bills. This just means that you are open to having them for discussion on the committee. So any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the measures are introduced as committee bills. Close the work session on that. Thank you, committee members. And now we're going to start our informational meeting on landlord-tenant law. And we've got Jim Straub and Jeff Medinger kicking us off. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Chair Kenny-Geyer and members of the committee, good morning and thank you for giving us this opportunity to sit in front of you today. My name is Jeff Edinger. My company owns and manages approximately 700 apartment units throughout the state of Oregon. We have other properties in other states as well. I'm also the current president of Multifamily Northwest, whose members own or manage approximately 200,000 units throughout the state of Oregon. And I'd like to start by clarifying some terminology this morning. There's a phrase that's being tossed around, no-cause eviction. That's improper. That's not the correct terminology. What is being called a no-cause eviction is actually an end of tenancy notice. An eviction is a specific legal action that requires evidence in court of violation of the lease terms. That could be non-payment of rent, criminal wrongdoing, repeated violation of a rental policy, or serious threat or incident of substantial personal injury on the premises. The tool that we are talking about in question here, end of tenancy notice, is a notice informing a tenant that a lease is expiring and will not be renewed. Both landlords and tenants use this tool. Each of them uses this to indicate that they want to terminate a fixed term lease at the expiration of that lease. For a landlord, it's an end of tenancy notice. For a tenant, it's a 30-day notice to vacate. For landlords, end of tenancy notices can be a critical tool to protect the safety and well-being of all residents in a building. These notices provide a way for landlords to address problem tenants when initiating eviction proceedings would actually create additional safety concerns for neighbors of the problem tenant or to the staff on site at that community. For example, a landlord could give an end of tenancy notice after multiple tenant complaints to a property manager or to police about drug or gang activity. In this case, a 30-day for cause or an eviction would be problematic because complaining tenants may not want to testify for fear of retaliation from that bad actor. We just saw a case in Portland where we had some retaliation from a bad actor. The residents that testified against that person ended up getting bullet holes through their doors because he came back with a gun, upset, and retaliated against them. This is real. Here's two examples of where my company has used no-cause notices at one of our communities within the last year. We have a paraplegic gentleman living in one of our communities. Upstairs, he had a neighbor who was harassing him regarding his handicap. The harasser claimed that because of his handicap, smells were coming from his apartment. He would confront and berate that gentleman. The reality was there were no smells. We sent five different individuals to investigate. Nothing came back. It was a delicate situation. We offered to move that complaining resident. He wouldn't accept it. The man became belligerent to both the paraplegic and to our staff. Fortunately, this person's lease was expiring soon. So what did we do? We were able to issue a no-cause end of tenancy notice and move that person along. No court, no testimony, great solution. The other example was when a male resident was making sexual advances to a single mother in the apartment above him. In addition to verbal advances, he would leave explicit notes on her door. Not only was she intimidated, but she was concerned for the health and safety of her family. I don't know what went through this guy's mind, but obviously he thought he had a right to do it. She complained to us many times. She complained to our office staff, but she did not want to testify in court. I don't blame her. I wouldn't want to. We knew we had a problem. We were able to solve the problem by using an end of tenancy notice to move him along. That mother feels safe in her home again. Now, these are extreme examples, but they're real. Here's another reality. End of tenancy notices are rarely used. We as property owners want to keep tenants. We want to keep our residents. We as property owners have a disincentive to purposefully turn over units. The costs associated with turning over a unit, the time in between that tenant and a new tenant moving in, can be thousands of dollars. It doesn't make sense. We don't do that purposefully. Now, the mission statement of Multifamily Northwest is to promote quality rental housing. The end of tenancy notice without stated cause is a critical tool to that mission. It's rarely used, but it's critical. Illegal activity, including drug sales, can be almost impossible to prove, but it puts the safety of other residents, of on-site staff, and the community at risk. It's not fair to subject responsible people, responsible residents, to the antics of illegal behavior, harassment, or to troublemakers. We all deserve the right to feel safe in our homes. Don't take away this seldom used tool, but important tool that helps us keep our residents safe. On behalf of Multifamily Northwest and our members, who represent 200,000 units throughout the state of Oregon, we urge this committee to allow landlords and our residents to keep this important tool. Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, good morning, and thank you for hearing my testimony today. My name is Jim Straub. I'm a third generation in the great state of Oregon, third generation landlord, and I've personally been a landlord for over 27 years. For three generations, my family and I have been a part of the housing solution, with supply side developing, building new rentals, as well as providing affordable housing. I come to you today speaking as the legislative director for the Oregon Rental Housing Association. The Oregon Rental Housing Association is operated primarily by volunteers and a small staff, all dedicated to supporting the mission of the state association, which consists of 14 local organizations, all dedicated to the same core principles: training and educating owners about changes in laws and providing educational opportunities to help do their jobs better. Oregon Rental Housing Association is a state association whose focus is the smaller rental owner operator. Most of our members have between 1 and 10 units. I'm here today to talk to you about without cause notices, how and why they are essential to providing safe and secure housing for our residents. Let me start with a personal example or two of how I successfully utilize this important tool for the safety of our residents. My long-term resident lived on one side of a duplex for 7 years. Let's call her Julie. A new couple moved into the other side of the duplex. A washer and dryer was shared by both sides of the property, but could not be accessed from an outside entrance. Within a few months of the new residents moving in next door, Julie called me on the phone, very concerned and upset, and wanted my help. She informed me that she didn't know what to do, she was scared and she didn't want to move, but she felt like she didn't have any choice. She explained that since the new residents moved in next door, she had recognized a pattern. She was very upset because her undergarments had started disappearing from her laundry. At first she thought she had misplaced them, but then the undergarments started reappearing into her loads of clothes. The undergarments were not in the clean condition that they could have been if they had disappeared from the dryer. The majority of the time, the undergarments simply disappeared and never reappeared. Because the washer and dryer could not be accessed from the outside of the rental property, she felt it was clear that the culprit had to be the resident next door. Of course, my first suggestion was that Julie contact the police. She had, but they indicated that they couldn't do anything without proof. There was no way that I, as a landlord, could prove who the culprit was. All I knew was that I had a long-term valuable resident who was scared, didn't know how to handle the situation, and was looking to me for help. I knew that I was going to lose one of these two residents. I also knew that without proof, serving a with cause notice would raise the possibility of retaliation against Julie. I wanted to retain the tenancy of Julie, who had done nothing wrong, and by that time was so frightened that she was forced to temporarily move in with a friend. A with cause notice would have required me to disclose her as the complainant and the nature of the situation, and she was scared to identify herself. Given the situation, a without cause notice was the only viable option to protect her and protect the tenancy. From a pure business standpoint, I had one set of residents who had just moved in, had a few months of rental history, but were really a potential unknown. Then I had another resident who lived there for 7 years, never violated the rules, paid her rent on time. One of the two residents would have to move out. Of course, I chose the one who had a long-term track record, who had also established and was vetted in the neighborhood. Allowing Julie to stay was important to both her and me. She was a part of the neighborhood. It was close to her work, and she felt it was her forever home. If I was unable to serve the residency without cause notice, Julie would have been unable to stay. My next example is a 20-plus year resident in one of my rentals, who is a single mother of three young children. Let's call her Susie. Susie lived on one side of a duplex and had shown herself to be very tolerant and accepting of residents on the other side of the duplex. Occasionally over the years, she would contact me directly when she was at an impasse with the neighbors. At times, she and her family were recipients of dirty looks and outright discrimination by the duplex neighbors. Real or perceived, this was important to Susie and impacted her and her family's peaceful enjoyment of the rental property. If I ever suggested a with cause notice to the neighbor to resolve the situation, she was very fearful about retaliation against her and her family. As a survivor of domestic abuse, this was very real to her. Although a with cause notice was not an option in these circumstances, we worked together to be sure that all other options, from personal communication to letter writing, etc., were tried before a without cause notice was issued. Had I not had the option to serve a without cause notice, Susie and her family would not have been able to remain in the unit and maintain their peaceful enjoyment of the property. They continue to this day to be great residents. These are just two examples of good residents who follow the rules and paid their rents on time, and who would not have been able to stay in their rental properties had with cause notices been the only option to address their circumstances. I am a white male, 6'1", 240 pounds, who is not used to feeling intimidated in any situation. But there have also been times in my property management career where I have shaken like a leaf in fear for my own personal safety and the safety of my coworkers because of the actions and behavior of residents. I feel had I given with cause notices which identified specific behavior or violations, that anger and retaliatory behavior would have been directed at me personally, and I was fearful of that, of the outcome. Some residents respond to with cause notices inappropriately and are unable to discuss the notice calmly. In without cause notices, they may be upset, but there isn't a specific trigger for them to focus their anger on. In these circumstances, landlords must be able to protect themselves and their coworkers if necessary by serving a without cause notice and informing the residents that we simply want the property back. Landlords seek out and want to keep responsible residents. Landlords are in the business of having properties filled. It's expensive and time-consuming to have vacancies, and there's a disincentive for landlords in doing so. When landlords give without cause notices, it is for a good and important reason, often for the safety of the residents and themselves. Without cause notices must be retained for the good of landlords and residents throughout our state. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Stark, and then Representative Sanchez.
Thank you, Chair Kingay. You said that the end of tenancy, the no cause evictions, that they're rarely ever used. Do you have a percentage, or can you show us data that says what percentage of the time they actually are used throughout the state, and in what types of scenarios?
Yeah. So the end of tenancy notice. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I'm so adamant about it because it's right. Not an eviction. So I want to make sure that we use the correct terminology. But I don't have state data. What we did was we use an online service that we have forms, and an end of tenancy notice is one of those forms. So of the 200,000 members that we have, we went through that database to see what percentage of the time those forms were used. And what we found was that it was less than 1% when we ran that data. I can't speak to the rest of the state. I can speak to our organization. Thank you. Very seldom.
Mr. Sanchez.
So, thank you. I'm confused by that, to be perfectly frank. So how many times the form was used versus how many times it was an actual no-cause eviction? It seems like you'd be able to have some kind of number on that one, first of all.
Well, I'm sorry. Are you looking for, the number 10, or is the...
Sure. In the last year, how many no-cause evictions were given? And, I'm sorry. I get this end of tenancy thing, but that's not the words that get used in the world.
And that's why I'm trying to correct it.
Yeah, well, okay.
So yeah, I can try and obtain that data, but the number that I have right now is a percentage. I apologize. I should have come more prepared with that.
So I mean, you understand the situation here, the reason why this is coming up in the first place, correct?
I do. We have a problem. I fully understand that.
So, you are most of... Sorry, I'm being improper here, but I'm just...
Please, this is a discussion.
So we have three minutes
it.
Left for questions, so if
yes,
you can try to get to a question.
I will get
them.
To the question. Are you doing long-term leases with folks? Is that how it works, and the leases are being broken with this process? Is that what's happening?
No, so this process, yes, we do long-term leases. We prefer long-term leases. We want people to stay in our communities and rent from us. What this process is if you have a year lease, or at the end of 2 years, your year lease is expiring. Maybe it's in 90 days it's expiring. Usually that's the case. We'll say, hey, Mr. Harasser, this just isn't working out. We don't want to subject people to court processes. So at the end of your lease, we're not going to offer you another lease. We're not going to offer you the opportunity to lease from us.
If I could interject, Chair Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Sanchez. My organization, which is more of the mom and pop than on institutional investors, the majority of our members do typically just do month-to-month tenancies, and they don't do long-term leases. And that's for a variety of reasons. Most often, the tenants are the ones that request that. So it gives them the greater flexibility of moving if they don't like the neighborhood that they move into, or if there is a change of jobs or situation. So a lot of times we offer the option of a one-year lease or a month-to-month tenancy, but by and large, most tenants prefer the month-to-month tenancy. So with a without cause end of tenancy notice, that's simply, you know, they have the right to issue us a notice of without cause end of tenancy at any point. We also reciprocally like that same right. So if there is a change in our circumstances, particularly the owner's circumstances, if they decide that they want to move into the property, or a couple of the situations that I've outlined previously, that gives the flexibility.
Okay, Representative Meek. See how quickly you can ask, so we can see if we can squeeze in Rep. Gorsuch here.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for coming today. My question is, a lease is a contract, right? And do you see any other type of tool to end a contract with somebody? Because this, with other the laws of month-to-month or lease, they have a fixed date and termination. I guess the question is, you know, without harming the public, is there any other way to give folks an opportunity to stay in their home longer if they are good tenants? And I know that it's a free market. So my question is, are you aware of any other states or municipalities that run a program other than just a termination of at the end of a contract, it's terminated, and you have no other opportunities?
Sure. Kenny Geyer, Representative Olson, Vice Chair Sanchez, Representative Meek. So you're right. A lease is a contract, and that's a pre-agreed upon beginning and ending date. Both parties enter into that contract knowing exactly what's expected of them and exactly when that contract ends. So there's nothing hidden. Those residents that move in and sign that contract realize that July 1st, of 2018, their contract ends, so they have a lot of advance notice. If they choose to stay, they can start renegotiating long in advance or look for alternative housing. But I go back to, landlords want to keep residents. We want to renew leases. We lose money on turnover. It's time-consuming to try to re-rent properties, to negotiate rents. You always lose money on turnovers. We want to keep good residents in the properties for as long as possible. My longest-term tenant is 27 years. Absolutely love it. So,
well, thank you.
So
thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. I know we have a lot of people to speak. I'm hoping that you can stay toward the end in case we have a few minutes to eke out at the end for any questions. Can you save?
It's really relevant to the gentleman.
Just really quick. Are you saying,
if you can answer it in 20
Mr. Ettinger,
seconds.
Are you saying that every time you use a no-cause eviction, it's for somebody that's violating the rules?
In my case, yeah. Usually, yeah.
So you haven't evicted people for other reasons using no-cause?
No, I haven't evicted. Okay. I don't know what other reason I would.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you very much. So next we have John Van Landingham to talk about landlord-tenant law and the FED process.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Van Landingham. I work as a legal aid lawyer in Eugene, in Lane County, and have for almost 40 years. It'll be 40 years in September. So that's all I've done other than drive a taxi cab in my working career. I have also served as the facilitator of something called the General Landlord-Tenant Coalition. So some of the veterans have heard of that group. There's also a Manufactured Housing Landlord-Tenant Coalition, which, by the way, I am facilitating this morning at 9 a.m., and I'm leaving this building at 8:50 a.m. So as the facilitator of the General Landlord-Tenant Coalition for almost 25 years, where landlords and tenants have gotten together and negotiated changes to landlord-tenant law, I've probably negotiated and written about a third, roughly, of the Oregon law on residential landlord tenancies. I'm not here today to argue for or against the use of no-cause notices. I was asked to sort of give some background on how landlords terminate tenancies, what the law says, how they happen, and how evictions happen, how the eviction judicial system happens. So that's my job, is to try to talk about the law and answer questions. First, let me note, you've got three handouts on OLIS for today, an outline of what I want to say, a calendar showing the timing for evictions, and another document that lists the eight different statutory bases for for-cause terminations of tenancy. So in the interest of time, I'm not going to go over that last one, just to note that those termination notices range from 24-hour notices to 60-day notices. And they're for all sorts of different conduct. Outrageous conduct in which a tenant threatens another tenant or the manager, to no-cause notices, which are 30 or 60 days. Let me start by noting there are three different kinds of tenancies that you can have in Oregon. The first is a week-to-week tenancy. Nobody rarely talks about them. They're residential motels frequently. The landlords in those cases can't charge a deposit, so there's a disincentive to use a week-to-week tenancy. But people who don't have much money may be renting a residential motel by the week, so they pay for a week in advance. The second kind is what's called a month-to-month tenancy. Month-to-month tenancies go on forever, unless one or the other side terminates it. They're self-renewing. In a month-to-month tenancy, the landlord can raise the rent with a 90-day notice. The third kind is a fixed-term tenancy, which people commonly refer to as a lease. And I want to talk about terminology in a minute. The Oregon landlord-tenant law does not use the word lease. It's either a month-to-month tenancy or a fixed-term tenancy. Both of them are contracts. They're rental agreements. Rental agreements are contracts. A fixed-term tenancy has a fixed starting date and a fixed ending date. It does end automatically on that ending date with no notice required. But in a fixed-term tenancy, neither side can unilaterally change the deal. Landlords can't raise the rent. Tenants can't leave without cause. Landlords can't terminate without cause. In a fixed-term tenancy, a landlord cannot terminate the tenancy except for cause, one of those eight cause bases that I described in one of my handouts. Okay. Month-to-month tenancies can be terminated with cause, the eight bases in my handout, or no cause. By either side, no cause. No cause notices for a month-to-month tenancy can either be 30 days during the first year. After the first year, they have to be at least 60 days. Terminology. Again, there's no such term in the Oregon landlord-tenant law as lease. But I'm going to use the term because a lot of people commonly use it. Leases often have provisions that provide for rollover. Not always. It's not required by the law. But a lease can have a provision that says at the end of the term, this rental agreement will roll over and become a month-to-month. Or it may provide for a new term. Okay. They're actually quite common in manufactured home parks. And there's a statute with regard to manufactured home parks that provides for how a landlord has to give notice and has to offer similar terms for the rollover to a new term. But we don't We don't have that in apartment law, which is what we're talking about here, the first part of Chapter 90. So fixed-term tenancies, unless they provide otherwise, end automatically with no notice. Any other tenancy, and we're talking largely about month-to-month tenancy, any other tenancy requires a termination notice for it to end. I have never in my 40 years heard a tenant say, I got an end of tenancy notice. What do they say? What would you think? I don't know whether any of you have ever been evicted. You've all been tenants at some point in your life. You got an eviction notice. Technically, I would say an eviction is the actual filing of the lawsuit in a court. Technically, I'd say it's a termination notice. But what people think when they get a termination notice is that they've been evicted. Jim Straub used the term without cause. There's always a cause. Landlords don't wake up in the morning and say, by God, I feel like evicting somebody today. Who will it be? There's always a reason. The truth is that with no-cause notices, they don't have to state the reason. So maybe a more accurate term would be no-stated-cause notice. In a no-cause notice, the landlord does not have to state the reason, even though we all know that there is a reason. You'll hear testimony on Thursday about concerns about that, but that's not what I'm here to talk about. For a tenant who gets a no-cause notice, there are only three defenses to prevent that notice from being implemented. The first is that there's something technically wrong with it. Oregon law is fairly technical. You have to give the notice correctly. It has to be for 30 days, not 29 days. It has to be served in a certain way. And if it's not, the notice is no good. That defense simply gets you a new correct notice from the landlord once that's pointed out, whether that's before court or in court. The other two are substantive defenses, and they are retaliation and discrimination. Retaliation, if a tenant can convince a court that the reason for the landlord's no-cause notice is to retaliate against the tenant because the tenant has complained about repairs or rebuffed the landlord's sexual advances or something like that, something of that nature. Discrimination would be where the tenant can convince somebody, the judge, that the reason for the no-cause notice is because the tenant is Hispanic or Black or Catholic or has children or has guests with those qualifications. So those are the only defenses to a no-cause notice. What happens after a tenant gets a termination notice? In our experience, most tenants leave during the notice period. Nobody has any idea of exactly how many that is. Nobody has any idea how many notices of any kind are used. There is no data collected anywhere in the United States that I know of on how landlords that give notices. Landlords are not registered. You don't have to register with anybody to be a landlord, at least in the state of Oregon. In Eugene, you have to register as a landlord because they have a rental housing code, Gresham, something, Corvallis, things like that. But there's no registration of landlords. Nobody tracks what landlords do. Landlords range from huge landlords to people who have 1 unit. So we don't know exactly what kind of notices that they use. But most, in our experience, most people who get a termination notice leave within the notice period. Why? They may recognize that they don't have a defense. The landlord's right that they should be terminated, whether it's for cause or no cause. They may be fearful that a future landlord will discriminate against them because they've been terminated, because a future landlord's going to know nobody gets terminated for no reason. The future landlord's going to know if you got evicted in your prior tenancy, there was a reason. It may be that the tenant is fearful of going to court or doesn't know what the tenant's rights are. There are lots of reasons why tenants don't contest termination notices. But in our experience, most people leave within the notice period. If they don't leave within the notice period, the landlord cannot use self-help in Oregon, can't lock the tenant out, can't shut the electricity off. That's a big part of Oregon law. The landlord has to file an eviction lawsuit. It's called an FED, Forcible Entry and Detainer, old English common law term. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense anymore, but that's the name of it, and that's what we all call it, FEDs. It's in the statute. So whether and when a landlord files an FED is up to the landlord. Let me ask you to look at the calendar that I gave you now, so you get a sense of how quickly these move. Right.
We're actually going to distribute that for the committee.
Oh, okay. I thought everybody was using
laptops. But it might be easier to
use paper. I use paper. I prefer paper. So in this calendar, this hypothetical, I've assumed that the landlord gave a 30-day or a 60-day no-cause termination notice, which expired on the last day of the previous month, and the tenant didn't get out on that last day. Oregon law and the FED process is very prescribed by statute. One, two, three. This is the way things happen. This is the timeline within which they must happen. So under Oregon law, the landlord can file an eviction lawsuit the very next day. Can file it in circuit court or in justice court. Not many people realize that. There are justice courts all over our state. Justices of the peace don't have to be lawyers. Many of them are. But you can file an FED in a justice court if you're a landlord. In Lane County, the justice court is in Florence. Landlord files the FED on the first of the month. A process server or the sheriff will serve a summons and a complaint on the tenant the next day. Doesn't have to be personal service. It can be attached to the front door. So on the second, the tenant gets notice to come to court. That's how a tenant responds. Unlike most lawsuits where you respond in writing, in FEDs you respond by showing up in person at the courthouse at that time. And that time is exactly 7 days later. Unless it falls on a weekend. Judges don't work on weekends. But 7 days later, on the 8th, is what's called a first appearance. If the tenant wants to defend, the tenant shows up right then and says, "Judge, I want to defend." That means setting a trial, what's called a second appearance. In Lane County and in Marion County, the practice is that that will be 2 days later. It's up to the landlord. The landlord can ask for more time. The tenant can't get more time without having a judge find that there's some great reason, like you've got surgery scheduled. So in Lane County, the trial would be on the 11th. That's how quickly that moves. If in other counties, Multnomah County, I've been told it's 7 days later for the trial. In counties in eastern Oregon where there are fewer judges, fewer courts, it could be as much as 2 weeks later. The statute allows a maximum of 15 days from the first appearance to the trial. So I've noted that here, that the 24th will be the latest possible date. At an FED, if the tenant wins, the tenant gets to stay. If the landlord wins, the landlord gets a judgment requiring the tenant to move out. Typically, the judge requires the tenant to move out that day because the judges know that there's a little bit more process left. Judge could require a greater amount of time, but most judges don't. They will give judgment for possession to the landlord that day, so that would be in Lane County on the 11th. If the tenant still doesn't voluntarily get out, the landlord enforces that judgment by going to the sheriff's office, paying the sheriff some money. The sheriff serves a notice of termination, a writ of execution that requires the tenant to get out within 4 days. So I've shown that on the calendar here. At the end of that period, the sheriff will go to the rental unit and physically remove the tenant, if required. Physically remove the tenant. So in dangerous tenant situations, that's a benefit to a landlord, and the sheriff is going to be the one who takes that risk, not the landlord. So that's the timing that's involved. If we were doing this with non-payment of rent, and let me tell you, non-payment of rents, in our experience, are probably 90% of all FEDs. Because as the landlord who testified earlier, they're in business to make money. They have to make money, and they don't evict people for no reason. And collecting or not payment of rent is the primary reason why people get evicted. So if it's a non-payment of rent notice, what Oregon law says is the rent can't be due earlier than the 1st.
Thank you.
So using that same calendar, there's a grace period of 7 days. On the 8th, the landlord could deliver to the tenant a 72-hour notice.
Thank you.
Saying you've got to pay the rent within 72 hours or you must move out. At the end of that 72 hours, that would be the 11th, the landlord can file the FED. Same process, services on the next day, the 12th, told to come to court on the 19th, trial on the 21st in Lane County. So that's the fastest lawsuit in the world. And it's one of the reasons why you don't see too many defenses, because it's hard to get a lawyer and get a lawyer up to speed in that amount of time. As I said, I've written most of these statutes. They're really written to be used by non-lawyers. You can have a lawyer in an FED trial. It's rare. If you were to go down to the courthouse in Marion County and watch FEDs, most of them are decided by default, in which the tenant doesn't show up. In the few where the tenant does show up, there are very few trials. What have I left out in my outline? A couple of observations. The quickest way to terminate a dangerous tenant is with a 24-hour outrageous conduct notice. if that's your goal, if you've got a creepy tenant, and by God, we are not here to pretend to protect creepy tenants, or tenants who discriminate against other tenants. The quickest way to get that person out is a 24-hour notice. The slowest way is a 60-day no-cause notice. Remember, you can in a month-to-month tenancy, after the first year, you have to, if you use no-cause, it has to be for at least 60 days. In both cases, the FAD process doesn't start until the notice period runs. 24-hour notice, you can file that FAD on the 1 minute after the 24 hours is up. 60-day notice, it's after that. Unless an FAD is filed, there's no record of any of this stuff. There's no record of termination notices. There's no master record somewhere. There, you know about credit records, credit reports. They don't know about termination notices. What they know about is court filings. So if an FED is filed, the credit reporting company will know that an FED lawsuit was filed against the tenant. That's what gets reported on the credit report. They won't also attach a copy of the termination notice. So getting a no-cause notice is not any better for the tenant than getting a for-cause termination notice in terms of your credit report going forward. And again, future landlords know you got evicted for a reason. There's always a reason. Who goes to court? As I said, we think anecdotally that most tenants don't go to court, that most of the cases are decided by default. We've done a couple of surveys because this question keeps coming up. But you, to do the survey, you have to actually have a physical person, in our case, a legal aid lawyer, go down to the courthouse and look through the files because there is no other way to do it, and it would be county by county. So in November, in this past September, some of our lawyers did it in Multnomah County and found that about 87% of the cases filed, the FEDs filed, were for nonpayment of rent. And this is just, remember, this is just for the FEDs filed. Again, most tenants leave after getting the termination notice and don't force an FED. But if a landlord files an FED, the data in Multnomah County was that almost 90% were for nonpayment of rent. Small numbers were for for cause or no cause, about equal numbers. In Deschutes County, a survey done last fall also, the numbers were lower in terms of termination rent, nonpayment of rent termination notices. So that's my quick FED eviction 101. I'd be glad to answer questions.
Okay. Representative Nierman, we'll work our way this way.
Thanks, Chair Kenny Geyer. So thanks for your presentation. I appreciate that, Mr. Van Landingham. So I'm a landlord. I have four units there, and I have contracts with all my tenants, and I think most of them are on not the fixed term, the other one, month to month. So in those contracts, it describes I don't use the term, but a no-cause eviction or a termination of tenancy there. So are those contracts grandfathered in? Because the state can't intervene on my contracts, can they?
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Nierman, how to answer this question without advocating for one bill or another, because that's not my job up here. So the bill that's going to be discussed on Thursday is House Bill 2004. And House Bill 2004 does, as most of the bills that I've worked on for my 24 years of negotiating bills in this legislature, will say something like, for fixed-term tenancies, these statutory changes only apply to new fixed-term tenancies entered into after the effective date.
So
on month-to-month, it can apply to those in existence now. So the short answer to your question, which I'm sorry I didn't give earlier, was yes, it would apply to your tenants if HB 2004 were to pass. Any change in the law about the use of no-cause notices would apply to you.
Real quickly, so the legal principle here is that the state can intervene into my contracts then?
Because they're month-to-month contracts, yes.
Okay.
Remember, because month-to-month contracts renew, the term is monthly, so they renew every month.
In general, what you're saying, the state can intervene in a contract then, right?
In a month-to-month contract, yes. In a fixed-term contract, no.
In a certain kind of contract,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
That's handy to know. So I'll be putting up legislation to give PERS Tier 1 recipients about a 10% haircut, right? I mean, if we can intervene in contracts, we can intervene in contracts, right?
So I think the point is contracts going forward. Because it ends at the end of the month, then it's technically a new contract. It'll apply to anything going forward. Am I interpreting that correctly? Okay, thank you. Representative Korzak.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Just really quickly, just one quick definition. Is a justice court a municipal court?
Chair Kinnegar and Representative Bush, no.
Oh, they are municipal, different.
Municipal courts would be the city of Albany, for example, has a municipal court. And FEDs don't go to municipal court as far as I know.
Okay.
They go to justice court just or circuit court, but not to municipal court. Municipal court might be traffic offenses or local ordinances, homeless, whatever.
So thank
and
you,
probably
Chair
Representative Olson could lecture me about municipal court.
Thanks, buddy. Yeah, right. I appreciate it.
Hey, good to see you.
Thank you.
Just really quick, as you were going through, and you mentioned basically Lane and Marion counties are the two that you're more familiar with. What is the cost to the landlord for filing the FED with and going through that first process with the sheriff? And then the second piece is, what's it also cost them then to get to the final eviction process?
So I should, Chair Kinnegar, Vice Chair Olson, I should give you those numbers later.
Okay.
But there is a cost. There's a filing. It's set by statute. There's a filing fee required of the landlord when the landlord files the FED. Mm-hmm. There's an answer fee required of the tenant if the tenant shows up at the first appearance and asks for a trial. There's a hearing fee required of the landlord if it goes to trial. And then after the trial, and then if either of them ask for a jury, there's a fee for that. After that, to get the sheriff to enforce the judgment,
right. There's
another fee
right. That
requires where you pay the sheriff to go out there. They're probably not the actual cost of the sheriff to do all those things. And there's also a service fee for the summons. So there's how many fees did I say? There are five different fees, four from the landlord, a filing fee, a service fee, a hearing fee, and a execution of judgment fee.
Okay.
So it's not cheap.
That was my point. Thank you.
Thank you. And could you put those on OLIS for us?
I will.
Okay. And then I have one final. I think we're down to the last minute. So if quickly, in the cases that were given before, the person who was harassing the woman upstairs or the person who was seemingly discriminating against the tenant in the wheelchair upstairs, are there what could you do in a for cause? What would be the alternative to the current no cause for getting somebody like that out?
Chair Kinnegar, if I were a landlord or a landlord's lawyer, I would advise using a 30-day for cause notice in which you serve the tenant with a notice, the bad tenant with a notice, and that notice gives, under the statutes, in that list of statutes, 90.396, I think it is the statute number, gives the tenant 14 days to stop doing the bad behavior. And if the tenant doesn't stop the bad behavior, the tenancy terminates 30 days after the notice. If the tenant repeats that bad behavior within 6 months, the tenant gets a 10-day notice with no right to cure. In my experience, I've done some dumb things as a lawyer and defended some dumb cases as a lawyer. If I were a lawyer and my tenant were accused of stealing a fellow tenant's underwear or of harassing somebody in a wheelchair, another tenant, those are losers. My experience, I believe a judge would easily find that to be cause. And the testimony, the evidence, could be the landlord's own experience in negotiating, working with these people about it. It doesn't have to be the neighboring tenant who's fearful. Even in the example of the duplex where one tenant is fearful of another tenant, the tenant who gets a no-cause notice is going to figure this out. I mean, it's not a secret that there's always a reason. So the bad tenant is going to understand somebody has squealed on him or her. And I can't solve the problem of dangerous tenants. But I can tell you that in my experience, those examples are the sorts of things that judges would quickly, including drug allegations. Judges are very cynical about drug allegations and quickly conclude that people are dealing drugs with minimal amounts of evidence. I believe those cases would be winners for a landlord.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
8:50, you need to run.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Okay, so next we've got Yoni Khan Jochnowitz to describe our discrimination statutes.
Chair Kinnegar, members of the committee, I'm honored to be here. Thank you for taking the time to invite me to address the issue of fair housing implications.
Your name.
No cause eviction.
Could you please give your name for the record, too?
Absolutely. My name is Yoni Khan Jochnowitz. I'm an attorney with the Fair Housing Council of Oregon. The mission of the Fair Housing Council of Oregon is pretty simple. We try to eliminate housing discrimination throughout the state of Oregon, not just in Portland, but throughout the entire state. Prior to that, I worked as a legal aid lawyer in Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln counties, stationed mainly in Albany and Newport. So I was a fair housing attorney working outside the Portland metro area, where I had a chance to see a lot of these things come to fruition. I want to point out that as an organization, Fair Housing Council of Oregon knows full well that we cannot fight housing discrimination alone. We rely extensively on partnerships with housing providers to eliminate discrimination. And without those responsible landlords to partner with us, our job would be infinitely harder. So I want you to know from the outset, I'm not here to demonize anybody. Without good housing providers, we simply cannot get our job done. So that's critical. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the Fair Housing Act. Fair Housing Act was passed into law in 1968, 7 days after Martin Luther King's assassination. It's a law that provides protections for everybody. And I want to clear up this misconception. I'm not saying any of you have the misconception, but there is a misconception often when I talk to various groups about these issues, that this is a law that gives added benefits to some subgroups of society at the expense of others. If you look around the room, everybody in here is a member of a protected class, right? We all identify with a gender. We all have a race. Some of us have a particular religious belief. None of us deserve to be denied housing opportunities because of those characteristics. None of us, right? So my point is that when we talk about gender discrimination, it's as much a violation of the Fair Housing Act to tell someone, I'm not renting you because you're male, as it is to tell someone, I'm not renting to you because you're female. And it is as much a violation of the Fair Housing Act to say, I'm not renting to you because you're white, as it is to say, I'm not renting to you because you're African American. So that's just kind of background information. I can tell you from my experiences working in this field throughout the state that housing discrimination is alive and well. Just the other day, we got a call in on our hotline, on our Fair Housing hotline, from an individual living in Clackamas County. They were Hispanic American. They called up a landlord, scheduled a showing for an advertised unit. Landlord sees this individual and recognizes that they're Hispanic. And the first thing they say is, I don't rent to Mexicans. And she says, sorry, I'm not Mexican. He says, well, Mexicans, they're just going to beat me up. I'm going to be physically attacked by Mexicans. And then he insisted after that that she pull up her pant leg to show that she had no ice anklet, some tracking anklet around her ankle. Wow. So housing discrimination is alive and well. Now, the connection between no cause and the Fair Housing Act, I think, deserves some consideration from this body. I'll tell you guys an anecdote. Not too long ago, an individual from Washington County showed up at our office. She was disabled, white individual, worked female, worked three jobs, and was confronting a situation where her floor was caving in. She described the situation to me as her floor looked like a cereal bowl, right? And she approached her landlord, and she said, this is exacerbating my disability. It's limiting my ability to function properly. Landlord comes and inspects the unit, says, all right, I'll look into it. She doesn't hear back for 3 weeks. She goes back, she checks in with this property manager, and says, hey, I just want to know, is there anything that can be done? This is really exacerbating my disability. Landlord says, I'm still looking into it. 10 minutes after she checks in, she's issued a no-cause eviction. 10 minutes. She shows up in our office after, you know, eventually finding herself there. And, you know, I decide to intervene. Again, this is a person who works three jobs, right? The no-cause eviction is a situation where she's going to have to basically, as a disabled person working three part-time jobs, is going to have to give up work to go find an apartment because she tried to enforce her right or pursue her right as a disabled individual, asking for a reasonable accommodation. I called up the property manager, and I said to the property manager, is it true? Did you issue a no-cause eviction 10 minutes after she came and checked in with you? He said, yeah. I said, okay, well, I have some concerns that violates the Fair Housing Act. Property manager responds, you shouldn't have any concerns. No-cause eviction is legal in the state of Oregon. I said, yes, you're right. No-cause eviction is legal in the state of Oregon, but retaliatory eviction is not legal. And the strength of a retaliatory eviction case is determined based on the proximity of the discriminatory act to the issuance of the no-cause eviction. 10 minutes is about as strong as of a case as you can build. Mm-hmm. Eventually, he relented, saw that he admitted he made a mistake, and we settled it. And again, it's not my job to shake people down. It's not my job to go after housing providers. It's simply an effort to just, if you can resolve it in everyone's best interest, you do it in a reasonable way. You work things out. Another example. This kind of involves discrimination. We had a call from a Hispanic individual in, I believe it was Clackamas County, lived in a 40-unit building. 37 out of the 40 units were occupied by white individuals, and this individual was one of the few minorities in the building. It's the only person, he was a good tenant, paid rent, no bad tenant history at all. The only person in the building to get a no-cause eviction. He approaches his landlord and says, "Hey, I've tried really hard to be a good tenant, never caused any problems, I've never missed rent. Can you just explain to me why I got a no-cause eviction?" And the landlord says, "Actually, I don't have to. I don't have to give a reason." Mr. Van Landingham did an excellent job of kind of explaining a couple of the defenses to a no-cause eviction. You know, one of them is retaliation. You can argue essentially that the landlord has issued a no-cause eviction because they're retaliating against you on the basis of you being disabled and requesting a reasonable accommodation. Again, the strength of these cases is determined by the proximity, right? So in a case where you have a no-cause eviction issued 10 minutes after, you know, it's been, you know, there's been a discussion of a reasonable accommodation, it's a strong case. Mm-hmm. But what happens in a situation where a bad actor landlord, and again, this is a small group, I believe, of bad actor landlords. I don't think it's everybody. But what happens in a situation where a bad actor landlord knows by law that they're required to give a reasonable accommodation, has to incur minor inconveniences or potential costs to implement that reasonable accommodation under the law, mm-hmm. and they either grant it or deny it, and they wait 3 to 6 months, and they're still a little fumed about it? Well, as an attorney, as an advocate, I have a much harder time building a potent case because 3 to 6 months has elapsed. So you can't argue proximity as being that direct, right?
And we're at time right now.
Sure.
Is there any burning question? Otherwise, I would ask if you could stay to the end and see if there's any burning questions on this issue. Discrimination. No. Okay.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate
it. For coming. So next we have Sean Jillians and Dr. Eric Fruits.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Sanchez. My name is Eric Fruits. I'm a Portland area economist and an adjunct professor at Portland State University, where I taught courses in real estate finance and also in urban economics. At PSU, I'm also the editor of a real estate journal that deals with residential and commercial real estate markets in the state of Oregon. I have a master's and a doctorate degree in economics. My research on residential real estate has been published in top-tier academic journals. I've also contributed to a widely used real estate finance textbook that's now in its 15th edition. One of the things that we're going to talk about today and probably throughout this session is going to involve preemption of local rent control regulations, and I'm going to argue that preemption must be maintained. Preemption makes sense in local when local markets are interconnected in such a way that the policies in one market spill over into other markets in other localities. A well-known and respected Harvard economist, Edward Glaser, who focuses on urban issues, he said that rent control imposes costs on people inside and outside a local jurisdiction. For example, a housing shortage caused by rent control in Portland could spill outside in the city limits and contribute to a housing shortage and higher prices in other cities such as Milwaukee, Gladstone, Gresham, maybe even Troutdale. When rent control stifles the turnover and shrinks supply, people looking to move into a community are going to be prevented by the lack of supply available. Imagine a U of O grad who has to turn down a job in Portland because she can't find housing within commuting distance. See, these spillover impacts provide a compelling reason to maintain preemption. Preemption also provides regulatory stability throughout the state. Portland's recent rent control ordinance should be Exhibit A in that stability. It was rammed through in a matter of weeks, contained an emergency clause that put the rent control in effect the second the last commissioner voted yes. Property owners had no time to anticipate the impacts and little time to react to it. Now, imagine, without preemption, a patchwork of cities and counties throughout the state writing their own unique rent control laws. Owners of properties across different jurisdictions will have to juggle each different set of regulations. Renters moving across the state will face the mess of each city or county having its own unique set of regulations. Portland's new rent control ordinance has no provision for city enforcement. Instead, Portland's dumped enforcement duties onto the courts, our already clogged courts. If preemption is removed, county courts will be hearing thousands of cases spanning different jurisdictions. Judges and juries will have to evaluate each case based on each locality's unique and idiosyncratic regulations. Imagine being taken to court for the crime of trying to recover your costs of trying to operate your property. Imagine possibly having to serve on the jury to determine whether a rent increase was too high. Oregon courts are notoriously backlogged with cases. Removing preemption will further clog our courts. Preventing these sorts of spillovers is exactly why preemption laws have been and are put into place. I also understand that you're going to be hearing testimony today and throughout the session about the benefits of what we now call rent stabilization. This is a new name for what was once known as second-generation rent control. Rebranding a bad policy does not turn it into a good policy. A simple scan of the economics literature provides a clear conclusion. Heck, even a comprehensive scan of the mainstream economics literature provides a clear conclusion. Rent control is bad policy. None other than Paul Krugman wrote in the New York Times that rent control is, quote, among the best understood issues in all of economics. Among economists, anyway, it is the least uncontroversial. As the old saying goes, the science is settled. Rent control reduces supply and creates shortages in rental housing. Sure, current renters are better off by paying lower rents, but prospective renters, the newcomers, the people who we want to have move into our area, are worse off when they can't find a place to live. Property owners become a lot more choosier about whom they rent to when they're staring down rent controls. When prices are capped, people have less incentive to fix up and rent out their space, their spare bedrooms, their basements. They have reduced incentive to build rental properties. Why face the nightmare of overregulation and rent controls when you can just simply flip it and sell it? Why rent out an apartment when you could sell it as a condo? Oh, and by the way, remember, housing prices for sale, condos and homes, those prices are rising just as fast or faster than rents in many areas. Another well-known feature of rent control is reduced maintenance. The urban economics textbook, I use this term, at PSU, was written by a Lewis and Clark professor, economist. He dedicates half a chapter to the economics of property maintenance. The science is settled here, too. If rent control reduces the revenues from property investments, you will see less property investment. Second-generation rent control, or rent stabilization, is complex, and it's designed to be complex. It's designed to be complex in order to delay and obscure the worst parts of the first-generation rent control. It's an economic version of wiping the fingerprints away from the scene of the crime. The crime has still happened. It's just harder to catch the culprit. Rent stability is more complex than rent control in the complicated rules it uses to determine how and by how much rents can rise. Add in a court system or a quasi-judicial panel, housing panel, and you've just built a regulatory morass. This is how you create a self-inflicted housing shortage. You may also hear testimony throughout the session that maintenance issues can be dealt with simply by vigorous code enforcement. In some ways, that's true. But remember, as we've heard today already, Oregon tenants are already protected against retaliation for reporting code violations. Adding in rent control does nothing to improve those already strong protections. Also, remember, code enforcers enforce the code. That's their job. They can't mandate that a unit get a fresh coat of paint. They can't mandate new carpet. They can't mandate a kitchen remodel. These are the types of things that go by the wayside with rent control. Here's the takeaway. Markets work. As much as we may not like it, markets work. Markets work through the price system. Costly regulations lead to higher prices. Second generation rent control doesn't stop the price increases. It merely delays them and obscures them and hides the fingerprints. Markets also work through supply and demand. If you make it unprofitable to supply housing, you will see less housing supplied. Rent control and rent stabilization lead to housing shortages and worsen existing shortages. This isn't PhD economics. It's Econ 101. It's textbook economics. It's New York Times economics. Rent control is bad policy, and rebranding it doesn't make it any better. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Fritz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. Welcome, Vice Chair Olson, to the fun here in the Housing Committee. Congratulations on your new position. Madam Chair and committee members, I thought maybe we'd look a little broader from our perspective as the realtors, because I think we see sort of the property management angle, but we also see the investment and the building of affordable and also market rate rental units and how that intersects with the for sale market as well and sort of how we got into the situation. So I don't think it's a big surprise to anyone that we have a lack of supply of housing in Oregon. Josh Lehner from the Office of Economic Analysis has been saying that for over a decade, that we're well behind our needed housing starts. And that's statewide, but particularly acute in the Portland metropolitan region. Right now, just to keep up with in-migration alone, we need 13,000 units coming on board every single year. That's just to keep in with it, up with in-migration. That has nothing to do with changing patterns and demographics and ages of folks. As the baby boomers age, millennials come in. I think we're going to see another shift with millennials as well. As they start having kids, their housing choices start to change as well. So our land use system, as beloved as it is, has not adapted as well as we might hope after 40 plus years, and it does have an impact on that. I was looking at some of Josh's work on rural Oregon. We have some of the least affordable rural areas in the entire country, and that is in large part due to our urban growth boundaries. Artificially constraining the supply there has a very disproportionate impact on it. You have communities such as Bend that have not expanded their urban growth boundaries since they drafted their original one, and they quadrupled in size. They're close to finally getting it done now, thankfully. But those are the sort of examples. And while the Portland metropolitan region has added a number of or thousands of acres for housing needs, other communities have not. Other communities have been stuck in legal limbo for decades, and many of them have given up, like the city of McMinnville. Woodburn actually was stuck in litigation for 20-plus years, spent over $1 million. Finally, the former state rep from here, Betty Comp, actually introduced a bill that said, enough is enough, we're going to validate the UGB. That brought the parties together, and they finally agreed on a settlement, and Woodburn was able to move forward as well. So what you all do has a potential implication on that. I know in the housing package in 2016, we did a very, very, very limited land use project. It's 100 acres total throughout the state. There was a great deal of interest as that has progressed through LCDC from local communities looking at if we can get the dirt for cheaper, can we drive down the cost of housing? That would be our contention. You have areas in the Portland metropolitan region where it's going for almost $1 million an acre for bare dirt. That's not services. That's not anything else. You are not going to end up with anything even remotely close to affordable when you're starting at $1 million an acre in bare dirt. Local government policies also have an implication on that. Look no further than the other side of the Burnside Bridge, where a brand new apartment complex faced significant delay in people moving in because the windows weren't mirrory enough, and they needed to put shinier windows on there. These are the sort of problems that developers face as far as design standards go. Some of them, while well-intentioned, tend to have the opposite impact. I would also point out a very well off neighborhood in East Moreland that has decided to downzone to allow less density going in there. And yet, when you look at our land use system, it's designed to increase density in our urban core. 61% of the Portland market is still single-family detached houses, 61%. And yet we make a lot of assumptions on our growth going forward that that will actually flip-flop, and it will be 60% multifamily. The market has not bared that yet. While we do need a number of multifamily units, people have not shifted completely away. And when you ask potential buyers, what do you want? They want a single-family detached with a small yard that they can walk to everything. They want basically what we don't have a lot of in Portland. They want Sellwood, right? That was developed years and years ago and is not very affordable. But as we look at the scale of folks moving up, these are sort of the implications you can have. When you're at the higher end of the rental pool, hopefully you're looking to purchase a home. And when you look at surveys of renters, 83% still say they want to buy a house. They still say that they view that as a wise investment. And historically, it's always been the biggest driver of wealth for the middle class is owning a home, paying off, building your equity in there. If we reduce the incentives for home ownership, that will have a significant impact. Since the inception of the federal tax code, the mortgage interest deduction has been there. Oregon has been tied to that federal tax code. If we reduce the mortgage interest deduction, that has an impact on people wanting to move up into home ownership. That frees up fewer rental units. The other thing that I would say, it's an interesting byproduct of the city jumping in or the legislature jumping in that I don't think was well thought out, or I can assure you it wasn't well thought out in the Portland instance, because we weren't even invited to the table. We being developers, property management companies, metro multifamily, et cetera. And that was pretty clear in the testimony of Commissioner Udaly that she purposely excluded us from the conversation. Things like that have implications where we could have pointed out some of the faults. Would we necessarily have agreed with the Portland ordinance? No. Definitely not as it's drafted. But we could have pointed out things like the gentleman who testified next to me in Portland City Hall, who had given a 90-day notice, had lost his job in another state, was trying to move back into his own home with his family, was on day 83 of the notice, and with that emergency clause now owed $4,500 to the former tenant to move back into his own home. He did not have the money. He had lost his job in another state. Now, ultimately, we were able to do amendments on the fly with Commissioner Fitz, and we excluded people with a single property out of it. But that wasn't even thought through. The thought of someone moving back into their own home because of their circumstances wasn't thought through. Now, the next point on relocation payments, I've been in a big dialogue with a bunch of accountants. Is this a 1099 situation? Accountants would say yes, this is income for those folks. So they need to pay taxes on the $4,500 relocation payment that they're receiving. That also has an implication on their benefits. If they're close to a certain income threshold, that could push them over for particular benefits. Not saying that it wasn't something that is necessarily warranted in the worst of circumstances, but it's things that we didn't think through. And it's things that as you all move forward, you need to have everyone at the table. And I know, Madam Chair, you've been excellent about that down here. I actually had a meeting with the mayor and I said, we do things a little differently in Salem. We feel like we're included in that. And that certainly wasn't the case in Portland. I'll wrap up with sort of some things that we've done recently in the last few sessions, because I know a lot of folks are new to the committee, might not know the history of a lot of things we've done. In 2009, we implemented a document recording fee to fund affordable housing. 13% of that goes to down payment assistance. The rest goes to rental programs, goes to preservation of existing housing stock. If you look back on that bill, it was introduced on behalf of the Oregon Association of Realtors, the Oregon Home Builders Association, and the Oregon Bankers Association. Now, we had our colleagues from the Housing Alliance and others where we had worked through our issues in the interim and said, here are the things we can't do. Here are the things you can't do. What can we move forward on? And we moved forward on that document recording fee, and we got the votes necessary after it had not passed for a number of sessions prior to that. We increased that by $5 for veterans with the same sort of thing going forward in session previous to that. We negotiated 60-day notice for tenants who have had over a year before they could receive a no-cause termination of tenancy. Whatever the terminology is we're using on that. I'm not as fluid in that. I'm much more fluid in the sort of implications for people purchasing and selling. In that particular 60-day notice negotiation, we as the realtors negotiated a different path for people who were good faith purchasers who wanted to move into their home so that within 30 days they could actually move into the home that they were purchasing because, you know, the easiest or sort of lower level as far as a starter home is typically something that someone has probably used as a rental recently. We agreed to a 90-day notice for rent increases. That was during our last legislative session. We agreed to inclusionary zoning, something I have fought for longer than I care to admit. I think I had no gray hair when we started this particular battle. And ultimately, we agreed to inclusionary zoning moving forward in communities in our state. We went a step further. Inclusionary zoning historically has only included for sale units. By definition, that's what inclusionary zoning is. We allowed it to apply to rental housing as well, too. So now up to 20% of units in these multifamily developments that are going forward in Portland can be required to be affordable going forward. We agreed to a construction excise tax for affordable housing, with the funds dedicated going to housing programs, both at the state level and at the local level. And I think you've seen some communities. Corvallis, I know, is very interested in. Portland's already put theirs in place. So I don't want you all who are on the committee to get a sense we haven't done anything on this front. We feel like we've done a lot. We feel like there are significant concerns and unintended consequences that could come about from some of the proposals that are going forward, both on the mortgage interest deduction, rent control, notices, relocation payments, et cetera. With that, thank you for the opportunity to present, Madam Chair. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great. Any questions from people? Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I have tons of questions for both of you, but in the interest of time, I do want to go back to one thing, Sean, and that has to do with the UGB stuff. So I understand that in some communities can be a big factor. What puzzles me is if you look at Portland, and it's not close to downtown, but there are some significant reserves that were brought in South of Gresham, about 10 years ago. And there's a little bit that's gone on there, but not much. So if we have the pressure in Portland, why haven't we pushed out more into the areas that are open?
Great question, Madam Chair and Representative.
A quick response.
Oh, come on. That just looks like a T sitting there with a giant softball.
wow, thank you.
Damascus is probably the worst land use decision we've ever made in the history of the state.
Yeah.
So we brought in the absolute wrong land, way too much of it. There is zero chance of services ever going out there. There's no governance. They fought forever over a comprehensive plan. So to their credit, I think you've seen Metro bring forward improvements to their system, including urban and rural reserves, mm-hmm. in an attempt to never repeat that. But Damascus does still sit out there, and it's the poster child for us of everything that's wrong with our land use system.
Quick follow-up.
I think we need, because land use can take us down a totally different path. We are going to be looking at a lot of supply issues, including better use of land, including permitting processes. A lot of that is coming to this committee, which is why we have to keep it moving. I'm sorry, we've got so much on the agenda. Certainly, we'll be looking at home ownership and everything we can do to improve home ownership, which the more we get people into homes, the more we release some of the pressure in the rental market. So I'll be delighted to look at that. I really want to thank you for the strong support you've given to the document recording fee. We know that that's one of the few sources of funding besides the low-income housing tax credit that we have. And I look forward to working with you to double that this time. It's one of the very few places that we have for trying to really get at the supply issue. So just want to thank you for all your work in that, and I know this is the start of many conversations.
And I
want to thank you, my constituent, I believe.
Yes, I am.
And I know a lot of the issues that he brought up are very hot in Laurelhurst in terms of land use.
You haven't even started.
I know that. So I know. I'm quite aware of that. So these are all hard, sticky issues.
And that's why I'm no longer chair.
Appreciate you coming down.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And so next we have Dr. Stephen Barton.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Steve Barton. I'm going to be speaking to you about the benefits of moderate rent stabilization programs. My basis for speaking will be both backed by the academic literature, to which I've made some contributions myself. I have a PhD in city and regional planning from the University of California, Berkeley. And I've spent 25 years as an administrator with the City of Berkeley working on the entire range of affordable housing programs and rent, its rent stabilization program. So basically, let's define what a moderate rent stabilization program looks like. There's quite a range within the rubric of rent regulation. From on the one end, you could have the wartime emergency rent freeze. On the other end, you could have ordinances that require mediation between the landlord and the tenant for rent increases over a certain level, with no requirement that such increases ever be rolled back, simply that there be some discussion first. In between is this large area of moderate rent stabilization. And I prefer the term rent stabilization because what it really does is it stabilizes the tenancy. And typically what they do is use a formula based on the increase in the consumer price index to set an allowable annual rent increase. It's not hard to figure out. You know, the CPI is readily available. Everybody knows what the formula is. And they will allow increases on vacancy in addition to that. In the state of California, that increase is to market. And the, whatever the market will bear is the rent at the start of the tenancy. And then the rent is recontrolled by the formula after that. In New Jersey, there are a number of cities that have systems that allow a certain percentage rent increase on change of tenancy, sometimes even a sliding scale based on how long the tenant has been in place. So you can develop a lot of complexity. You can also have a system that's really pretty simple. All of these systems also include very substantial periods of exemption for new construction to ensure that they are not discouraging new construction. In California, it's mandated by state law that new construction is simply exempt from rent stabilization. There are other places where there might be an exemption of 10 or 20 years. So that's the kind of system we're talking about. It's one that slows the rate of rent increases over time, but actually, in the long run, it does not hold the rent down by an enormous amount. So why would you do something that, in the long run, doesn't hold the rent down by an enormous amount? Well, the real estate industry always tells us that home ownership is the way to go because homeowners are stable and tenants are transient. But an awful lot of people are going to spend decades of their lives, and for many of them, it's a significant minority, their whole lives as renters. They're not going to be able to become homeowners, and they need stability in their lives too. There's a really pretty substantial public health literature now on the effects of things like forced moves in creating stress in people's lives and how harmful that is, particularly to children and elderly people. So, of course, and rent stabilization, I will say, is simply the absolute best program you can come up with to reduce forced displacement. Now, economists typically criticize rent stabilization, saying that it reduces tenant mobility and makes the market less efficient. Note the change in language here. For homeowners, we talk about the civic language of community, that stability is a good thing. But when it comes to renters, we say, oh, this results in immobility and makes the market less efficient. Well, so transience on one side, mobility is the same thing, but with a positive connotation. Stability, positive, immobility, bad. It depends what values you want to bring to your community. But for some reason, only renters are supposed to have their lives subjected to the rigors of economic efficiency, while homeowners are supposed to bring the benefits of community. And I think, again, at the very least, there's broad agreement that rent stabilization stabilizes renters. The disagreement comes on what value you give to the efficiency of being able to push people out of their homes. So, how does moderate rent stabilization do this? It does it by limiting unreasonable rent increases. What on earth do I mean by unreasonable rent increases? Well, my starting point is actually a perfectly or reasonably competitive market. The rent that would be provided under a fully competitive market without barriers to increase in supply is, in fact, the appropriate rent. In a perfectly competitive market, the market provides its own rent control because competition pushes the price of the product down to the absolute minimum necessary to profitably operate and maintain the good that's being brought to market. When you have rapid rent increases going on in an area, can anyone say that the market is holding the rent down to the absolute minimum necessary to profitably own and operate the property? Was Portland 5 years ago a deteriorating hellhole? No. Moderate rent stabilization programs ensure that the landlord receives a rent that is at least equal to, and usually actually greater, than what would be provided in a fully competitive market. Now, why isn't the market fully competitive? You've heard some of the reasons, although I think you focus particularly on this first one, restrictive land use regulations. The largest single government barrier to increased supply of rental housing is single-family zoning. And you know what? That's backed by the full force of the American middle class, and you're never going to get rid of it, although you'll be able to nibble around the edges on some things. The second is the higher cost of construction in urban areas. It's just the case that building infill housing and building at higher densities costs more money. And that means that you're just not going to be able to, through new construction, get housing costs back down to what they once were as an area becomes more dense. And finally, there are major time lags in construction and in the filtering down, because most renters don't rent new housing, they rent older housing where the costs of construction have been amortized. There's a saying in gardening that the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago. Well, the best time to have a boom in housing construction is 20 years before you have the economic boom that brings a whole lot more people into the area. But that's not how the market works, so you have some pretty significant imperfections. Economists have long recognized, in fact, you can read this in Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, the founding book of market economics, that housing involves a couple, the rent of housing involves a couple of components. One is the building rent, the amount actually needed to profitably operate and maintain the building, and the other remaining amount of rent is what Adam Smith called the ground rent, what economists today would call land rent or locational rent. And it's sort of a basic axiom of economics. It is, in fact, economics 101, that if you tax or regulate in a way that affects the land rent, then it will not affect the operation and maintenance of the good itself that's being produced of the housing. It's also important to recognize that the value of the location is not created by the landlord. The value of the location is created by the larger society. So I will simply say, as kind of an axiom, that if the larger society creates that value, then it has the right to regulate or tax that value. In the case of moderate rent control, all that it's doing is slowing the increase in the unearned land rent in order to mitigate the unearned rising land rent in order to mitigate its most harmful effects on tenants. Now let's talk for a moment about maintenance. It's kind of ironic to suggest that if rents are rising rapidly above the level that a truly free market, a sort of impossible but ideal free market would provide, that slowing the rise in that excess rent increase would lead to deterioration and under maintenance. But let's look at how markets work. And this is even in areas that have very high rents nationally. In the San Francisco Bay Area, you will find tenants at the bottom of the housing market living in deteriorated units, paying rent that's actually higher than garden apartments with swimming pools and tennis courts in, say, the Houston area. Why would that be? Well, when people are barely hanging on in a market and keeping themselves housed, they have no bargaining power. The result is that some landlords take advantage of this. So how is it that they can take advantage? Well, because if the tenant has no place else to go, then they'll pay almost as much for a deteriorated housing unit as they will for one that's in good condition. And what determines whether a building will be well maintained is not the absolute rent level, as long as there's enough rent to profitably operate and maintain the building. What determines how it's maintained is the difference between the rent the owner gets operating a well-maintained building or a poorly maintained building. Now, fortunately for us, there are a lot of landlords, especially smaller landlords, who have pride of ownership and keep up the buildings and follow the rules. But under those circumstances, where you have a housing emergency, where there's a shortage, you get people who are able to take advantage of that because they know that they'll get pretty much as much rent even if they don't maintain the building. Rent stabilization helps you answer that because under rent stabilization, tenants can petition the rent program and ask for rent reductions based on the loss of housing services that they were supposed to have had in the first place. Rent stabilization discourages speculation. It typically is accompanied by good cause for eviction, which means that someone can't simply buy a building and kick all the tenants out. Running out of time, so I won't belabor that one. And the economics literature is actually pretty clear that moderate rent stabilization ordinances have no effect on new construction. In the Bay Area, new construction of multifamily housing is actually more prevalent in the cities that have rent control. That's not because rent control causes new construction either. It's because the cities that have a majority or a large proportion of tenants are more likely to pass rent control, and they're also less likely to be impressed by arguments that if you build multifamily housing, it'll bring those renters in. And they're more friendly to the construction of multifamily housing. So, there's a running joke that the city bird of San Francisco is the construction crane. You could say that for Berkeley as well. We have an enormous amount of new multifamily housing currently under construction. So, just comment that I've been in this business for a long time, and back in the late 70s, when California cities were first considering rent stabilization, people would point to the South Bronx in New York, where there was abandonment going on, and predict this grim future for Berkeley and San Francisco and other places. Pretty nice cities, if you ask me, after what's now 40 years of rent control. Moderate rent stabilization, I should say. I understand that some people have tried to turn that around and say, oh, well, It's because of rent stabilization that rents are so high in those cities, because it's discouraged new construction. But it hasn't. Again, if you want to look at the Bay Area as an example, you'll find that in between San Francisco to the north and Silicon Valley to the south is an entire large county, the peninsula, San Mateo County, occupied by what used to be small commuter towns, predominantly made up of single-family homes that are adamantly resistant to new construction. So, again, there's a wide range of issues, but it's not rent control that's resulted in the supply shortage. So, rent stabilization will not, as I say, in the long run, hold rents down. It's not the permanent solution to affordability problems. What it is a program that enables tenants to have stability in their homes, so that if you have an elderly person or a family that spent their entire lives in a community, their relatives are there, their social ties are there, you don't just have the ability to say, well, we have a tech worker making a whole lot more money, so let's kick these people out, heedless to the effect that it has on them, and bring in the new tech worker because it's better for our economy. It says, let's take things a little more slowly. Let's give people stability in their lives and in their homes, because it really means a lot to them, and that's a fundamental value for us if you make that decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Martin. Questions? So I have a question. Often people talked about rent stabilization and no cause needing to go together. Mm-hmm. Do you have no stated cause policy in Berkeley?
Yes, we do. And the rationale here is that if you have a system that gives substantial rent increases when a tenancy changes, mm-hmm. then you need to protect people because you've created an economic incentive for evicting people in order to get that increase. Now, we also have rules that say that, if an eviction takes place and it later proves that it was a sham, that it was an eviction to owner-occupy, and the owner didn't, in fact, move in, that they simply rented it to a new tenant at a higher rent, mm-hmm. there are consequences for that. So you definitely need to bring the two together.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Other questions? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question related to, over the last 40 years of rent control, both in the Bay Area and Berkeley, what is the number of workforce housing or folks that live in the Bay Area that work in the Bay Area, or do they commute out of the region in order to be able to afford to work in those cities?
The overwhelming majority on the, and I don't have the statistics here, of people who work in the Bay Area, live in the Bay Area. It's a big area. I would generally say that, again, since rent stabilization has no effect on construction of homes and has not created the supply shortage, that it's not really, there's definitely a housing shortage in the Bay Area. We've had an enormous economic boom. And we also have a major construction boom going on. We have a construction boom so large that construction costs have started rapidly increasing because there's a shortage of the skilled workers necessary to actually build apartment houses. It takes more skill to build housing at high densities than it takes to build at low densities. So there's a shortage of skilled workers, although the unions complain to me that the workers aren't seeing the increased money, that just the construction companies are getting it. But that, that's nonetheless the case. Supply in the Bay Area has been absolutely unable to keep up with the increase in demand based on the tech boom that we're having. And I gather that some of that is starting to spill over to your area.
follow-up, Chair. I guess, is there any research available? What I'd like to see, because I think what we're facing here in the Portland metro area and all around Oregon, is displacement of folks that have grown up here because they can no longer afford to live here. I'd like to see if there's been any research done in those areas of how many folks that lived there 40 years ago or even 20 years ago still live there without their churn and turnover because of unaffordability, whether it's rent-controlled or stabilized or not. Were they able to still maintain as citizens of those communities?
Yes. Well, I can report to you more anecdotally, but from observation, that the cities of San Francisco, Berkeley, and Oakland have had very little displacement. That it comes down to occasional really major, fights over one 90-year-old woman in a where there's a owner-occupancy eviction going on, which is a good cause for eviction. Whereas in cities that don't have rent stabilization, they've had massive displacement, which is why you had five cities in the Bay Area in this last election cycle voting on whether to bring in rent stabilization. Two of them passed it, three of them were defeated. So I would say for those who want to know whether rent stabilization works, the answer is if your purpose is to stabilize tenancies, it works very well. There are other purposes such as, maintaining the long-term affordability of the housing. For that, you really need other programs.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Well, that's thank you for that distinction. I would think it seems like a clear case for displacement because you're not seeing what we see here with the continual ending of termination of rentals for whole buildings with kids who are now making up a big part of a school district. So it sounds like the policies that you've used in California really get at stabilizing the communities, whereas if you want to hold down the prices for long-term affordability, that probably gets more at a supply issue. Because otherwise, the new construction that's coming in sets to the market. And if you still have way more demand than supply, you're still going to have that price pressure.
Yeah, a combination of supply of for-profit market rate housing and of nonprofit
subsidized
long-term subsidized
right.
affordable housing.
Okay, great. Any other distinctions between cities? I know that you are most familiar with the Berkeley, but you've got it in San Francisco, Santa Monica, other places. Any other distinctions that you want to let us know since we have a rare opportunity to be able to talk to you in person?
Well, within California, there's a wide range of of types of moderate rent control programs. I'd say the major distinction would be between programs that engage in very active enforcement and those that are more passive and complaint-based. Mm-hmm. So, for example, San Francisco and Los Angeles run complaint-based programs, and that gets run at a pretty affordable rate. It only costs them about $50, $60 per unit per year to run those programs. Berkeley, Santa Monica, a couple of other cities run very active programs where we require landlords to register the rent when a new tenant moves in. We send a mailing to the tenant to verify that. We engage in extensive outreach to landlords and tenants about the program and people's rights and responsibilities under it. We do an enormous amount of counseling and mediation, and that costs money. So our program costs over $200 per unit per year, roughly four times as much as those of the cities that have more limited programs. The Los Angeles did a study of a survey of its tenants and found that roughly 20% of its tenants were reporting rent increases that were actually above the legal allowable amount. We did such a survey in Berkeley the following year and found under 5% reported rent levels that might be illegal under our rent ordinance. So For the lower amount of money, you can get 80% compliance. And if you're intent on trying to get close to 100%, it's going to cost significantly more. These programs are typically paid for by fees charged on a per unit basis. In some cities, the fees are split between the landlord and the tenant in that they can then pass on half the cost of the program to the tenant. In other cities, especially with vacancy decontrol allowing rents when tenancies turn over to go up to market, other cities like Berkeley have ended that practice, and the landlord absorbs the cost of the program.
Okay. Thank you. No more questions? Thank you very much for sharing your experience from another region of the country. Okay. And last up, we have Martha McLennan.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. Thank you for inviting me. My name is Martha McLennan. I am the Executive Director of Northwest Housing Alternatives. We're a nonprofit affordable housing provider. We currently have a portfolio of over 1,800 units in 15 Oregon counties. 1,550 of those units are multifamily rentals. The balance are special needs properties and group homes. We are just one of the nonprofit organizations that do this kind of work in Oregon. Between the nonprofits and the housing authorities, we probably represent more than 40,000 units statewide. Our industry has grown up with a tradition, mandated through some of our funding sources, of only using for-cause evictions. So that's what I want to talk about a little bit today. In our portfolio, we had 22 evictions in 2016. So that is out of 1,550 units. Evictions are something that landlords generally use very rarely. Only as a last resort. You have heard that from kind of both perspectives of folks who would like to keep the no-cause notice and folks that are adapted to using the for-cause notice. So evictions are very rare. We have a tenant population that's very low income, very needy. Our average tenant income is $14,400 a year. 27% of our residents have a disability of some sort. We routinely are open to residents who may have a fresh start or a rent well certificate, so folks who may have had difficulties at some point in their life and may have some barrier to housing in the form of credit, landlord history, or criminal history, that we're giving a second chance when they come and move into our properties. So we are kind of, as a rule, maybe taking on higher risk tenants than the open market would take on. Again, we had 22 for-cause evictions in the last year. You've heard a couple of reasons that folks might want to use, might have an eviction come to pass. The first is a bad actor resident of some kind. A couple of comments about that. One, we would never ask a resident to come and appear in court to complain about another resident. That would just not be our practice at all. We would work closely with our staff to document any behavioral issues or problems. We would work closely with other neighbors, either in the property or in the neighborhood, to document those. And we would work closely with the police departments in those communities to document that bad behavior. With that documentation, we are able to go to court for a for-cause eviction. And again, we would never ask a neighbor to come and testify and in that kind of face-off way. We also bring the police in if our management staff feel endangered in any way. So if there is a confrontation at a property, we would instantly bring the police into that situation. In that kind of case, that becomes a 24-hour notice. If there is a violent episode at our site, that's a 24-hour notice and a for-cause eviction. Another reason that you could see evictions in a property are situations of bias. And you've heard a couple of situations described here today. I would add one kind of from my personal experience prior to my tenure at Northwest Housing Alternatives, but from my personal experience. I had a neighbor who had lived at a property for a decade. I was his neighbor for a couple of years. He had cerebral palsy. He lived in a wheelchair. He had difficulty speaking. About a year after I'd left that property, a new manager was hired to run that property. The person was inexperienced, younger, and had been expressing her bias about how this individual gave her the creeps. So she issued a 30-day no-cause eviction on him. I asked him if he wanted to file a suit because I thought he had a good case. He didn't want to do that. He just wanted help moving somewhere else. He didn't want to live somewhere where he wasn't welcome and respected. But that is not an unusual case. The third reason that people might move somebody on is really an economic opportunity or an economic gain that they perceive. At Northwest Housing Alternatives, we also operate an eviction prevention program, rapid rehousing program in Clackamas County. We serve about 225 to 250 households a year in that program. And we get phone calls from 10 times that many seeking our assistance. What we're seeing more and more of is people saying, I haven't been evicted, but I have a $300 rent increase, and I'm on Social Security, and I can't stay, and I need help to move. I think the economic condition of our market right now is making us very prone to that. And you've talked a lot about the supply and demand issues, and that is certainly a piece of that. But the math at this point for somebody who has not been raising the rents consistently, or who sees an economic advantage or opportunity, or is a new owner who's just acquired a property who sees that opportunity, there are very, very large rent increases that are destabilizing people who have been in properties for many, many years. So that is another concern that we have right now. And the for-cause eviction would be one way of minimizing or softening the pace and degree to which that's happening. So I think I can leave it at that and answer questions. I think my perception is this, that the consumer protections always lean to the side of the consumer. You wouldn't want a toy company to sell a dangerous toy to your child, or an automobile company to sell a dangerous automobile to you. In the same way, when we need to lean in one direction or another in a landlord-tenant relationship, my suggestion is that we lean a little bit to the side of the tenant. The rental property industry is a profitable industry. It is a difficult industry. It is hard work. It requires significant discipline. But it is a profitable industry. The people who live in that housing need protection and need to have stability, to succeed in life, to have their kids succeed in school, to be able to have health, and to succeed economically. So when we lean, I think we should lean on the side of the consumer. I think landlords perceive in some respects that a no-cause eviction is a shortcut. As John Van Landingham explained, it actually takes longer in many situations to have somebody leave the property, but it is less confrontational, and it does require less discipline, and it does require less documentation of the problem. So in some ways, it is easier, but not necessarily necessary and not necessarily better. And with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Any questions from the committee? You know, I am left kind of wondering about the ones, while it may be easier, it could just pass the problem along because it's not identified for cause in a court, and so that tenant may go on and cause another problem somewhere else. So I think trying to capture the problem and trying to, you know, identify it and deal with it in some way seems important. I'm curious, out of the 22 evictions that you did last year, out of the 15,500...
1,500, not 15,000.
I'm sorry, 1,550.
Yeah.
So you had 1,800 units, 1,550 were multifamily units. Those are the ones that had evictions, not... They
correct.
All came out of that, the
yes.
multifamily. Can you say how many were for non-payment versus other issues?
I thought you would ask that question, and I don't have that statistic. My inclination is to say that probably 70 to 80% of them are non-payment.
Okay. Same with what, so similar to what John Van Lanningham said. Okay. Okay.
Okay.
Well, thank you. We are right on time for closing right before 10 o'clock. I'm going to close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Thank you very much.
There you go.
Thank you very much.
There you go.
On Human Services and Housing.